Hi, everyone. Judge Andrew Napolitano here for Judging Freedom. Today is Thursday, April 9th, 2026. My dear friend and colleague, Max Blumenthal, joins us now. Max, it's a pleasure. Thank you very much for your time today. Is there a ceasefire between the United States and Iran as we speak?
No, there's not a ceasefire. And it looks to me, having lived through the last 3 years and seeing how pauses in, for example, the Gaza genocide were exploited for Israel to remobilize and rearm, that we're witnessing something similar as U.S. Marines are being deployed to the region. And as Israel was on the verge of running out of interceptors and Iran had really consolidated its momentum, the United States, via Pakistan, attempted to create the impression of a ceasefire. Now, this allowed Donald Trump to game the markets. And we're seeing that some White House insider has placed a close to $1 billion bet on the price of Brent crude going down as Donald Trump sent oil prices tumbling with his announcement of his acceptance of Iran's National Security Council's 10-point plan as a baseline for discussions and negotiations. But the more revealing part of this ceasefire was how the United States government, looks like the State Department, had provided Pakistan's Shahbaz Sharif, Pakistan's leader, with the framework or the terms that were agreed upon for the ceasefire as a draft, and Sharif or someone in his office posted the draft, including the header that said terms for Sharif. And then they edited the tweet on X, but everyone could see that he had basically been fed these terms. These terms explicitly included Lebanon as part of the ceasefire. So the United States had agreed to include Lebanon. Iran had agreed to include Lebanon through Pakistan. So what does Israel do? Commits one of the worst massacres in history in Lebanon, massacring over 250 people, wounding over 1,200 people. There are families lining up outside hospitals to identify the bodies of over 90 people today. They were bombing not just the Dahiya section of Beirut, which is the Shia majority area, where Hezbollah has had some offices, and they can always justify mass destruction and killings of civilians on that basis that it's majority Shia. They were bombing areas like Ain Reisi, the Corniche in the center of Beirut, areas where opponents of Hezbollah live. They killed a famous Lebanese poet and her husband. Entire families were killed inside their homes. They bombed a funeral in a cemetery with a 500-pound bomb. The entire purpose of this was to sabotage the ceasefire and to provoke Iran into defending its ally in Lebanon. And what does the White House go and do? Including J.D. Vance, the so-called restrainer. J.D. Vance said, oh, well, those terms, they were actually AI. That was all AI-generated slop. In other words, they're basically denying that there ever was a ceasefire deal that included Lebanon.
So the 10 points that the United States sent to Sharif.
These weren't 10 points. Iran's National Security Council, which advises Iran's leader,
right,
Mojtaba Khamenei, introduced a 10-point proposal for what Iran sought to elicit from the talks. And these are basically, this is the framework for Iran's sovereignty going forward. And Sharif posted the terms that had already been agreed upon in order for this cessation of hostilities to have discussions in Islamabad. And those terms explicitly included Lebanon. I mean, you can just go to his X account and see it right there. And then once Israel decides we don't want to include Lebanon, We want to blow up all of Lebanon, like they attacked the entire country and attacked civilians explicitly. Like it was a performative slaughter. Once they did that, the Trump administration was forced to pull back, and it shows you the entire dynamic, which is that Israel determines when the U.S. goes to war and when the U.S. stops under Trump.
Here's the U.S. chief negotiator who, as we speak, is somewhere between Washington and Islamabad. And on his plane are the two people that Foreign Minister Arachi told him not to bring.
Yeah.
Kushner and Witkoff. But here's the vice president saying just what you said, Max. Oh, it was just a misunderstanding. Chris, cut number 22.
I actually think, and there's a lot of bad faith negotiation and a lot of bad faith, you know, propaganda going on. I think this comes from a legitimate misunderstanding. I think the Iranians thought that the ceasefire included Lebanon, and it just didn't. We never made that promise. We never indicated that was going to be the case. What we said is that the ceasefire would be focused on Iran, and the ceasefire would be focused on America's allies, both Israel and the Gulf Arab states. That said, the Israelis, as I understand it, again, I'm supposed to get a fuller report when I get on the plane, have actually offered to be, frankly, to check themselves a little bit in Lebanon because they want to make sure that our negotiation is successful. That's not because that is part of the ceasefire. I think that's the Israelis trying to set up us up for success, and we'll, of course, see how that unfolds in the next few days. But look, if Iran wants to let this negotiation fall apart in a conflict where they were getting hammered over Lebanon, which has nothing to do with them and which the United States never once said was part of the ceasefire, that's ultimately their choice. We think that would be dumb, but that's their choice.
Their truth in what he just said.
I mean, we were told J.D. Vance was the one who engineered this ceasefire, working with China, which has normal diplomatic relations with Iran and somewhat normal relations with the U.S., so they're like a key broker here. But you can see from his comments that he's very poorly informed. And these comments are disqualifying for J.D. Vance as a president. And that he is lying. He's just lying through his teeth because the terms are right there on Prime Minister Sharif's X account, and it included Lebanon. And Lebanon does not have nothing to do with Iran or the broader conflict. It was Israel that decided to launch a ground invasion into Lebanon after it secured U.S. support, basically secured the U.S. as a proxy force for attacking Iran. So it was Israel that launched the assault on Lebanon and made Lebanon a part of the war. It is Hezbollah that's defending Lebanon from Israel. And it is Israel that decided to blow up the ceasefire by attacking Lebanon. And so J.D. Vance is not only being dishonest, he's presenting a version of reality that flips on its head what Israel is doing before everyone's eyes. And so this is disqualifying for Vance. I feel very concerned about Vance supposedly offsetting the ideologically Zionist negotiators, Witkoff and Kushner, who are going to Islamabad. I don't even know if J.D. Vance will be present there. And of course, it looked like he was speaking from Hungary, from Budapest, because he was sent off to campaign for Orban to get him out of the way. So how much latitude does he even have here?
Here's Netanyahu insisting that Lebanon was not part of the deal, but boasting about his bombs and killings. Chris, number 19.
I have said that I've insisted that the ceasefire with Iran does not include Lebanon, and this is what is happening. Today, we have dealt Hezbollah the biggest blow that it has suffered since the pager operation. We targeted 100 command sites, headquarters, in 10 minutes. They didn't know what happened.
Let's see. Are those places that you articulated, a funeral home, a park, the famous corniche, a shopping center, and residential neighborhoods in the suburbs, command centers? Come on.
Well, they thought they were going to score this masterstroke. And so they dialed up their explosives. They launched 100 sorties, 100 strikes with 65 jets in 10 minutes. and they thought they were going to get Hezbollah General Secretary Naim Qassem, and they failed and wound up blowing up several apartment buildings filled with civilians, just as they did in order to kill Ali Larijani, who was the key negotiator for Iran. When Israel assassinated him, it attacked, I think, five separate locations, slaughtering well over 50 civilians. So what Israel has done is continued to expose itself as a mass killing machine, which is not doing well on the ground in southern Lebanon. Israel's ground invasion has been stalled. Its objectives have been rolled back. They're announcing that they're not actually going to seek to occupy all the land up to the Litani River. They're taking lots of casualties. There have been complaints from the Israeli general command that the army is essentially falling apart and that reservists aren't showing up. It's effectively a mercenary army where soldiers have to be paid to show up. They've lost helicopters. They're concealing losses. The Merkabas are getting hit by FPV drones for the first time. We didn't see this at this level during the last round. And now they're going to try to take Bint Jebel, which is a real strong point, a central node of Hezbollah's Radwan forces. And Israel was unable to take this area in the 2006 war. It actually wasn't even held off. It was held off by local Hezbollah guardsmen. So what they're doing is compensating, or I should say overcompensating, for their losses on the ground. Israel as a military isn't so great on the ground. You know, they have some good special forces, but they're essentially an assassination and killing machine that relies entirely on U.S. firepower. And so all they're able to do is these performative slaughters in order to blow up the ceasefire while they continue to control Donald Trump and hold his administration by the short and curlies.
I realize that the IDF and the Israeli government is very heavy-handed with respect to censorship.
Yeah.
But do you know from any sources how badly Israel has been damaged by Iranian missiles and drones?
Well, it wouldn't be Israel per se, given the way that Iran has gone about targeting. It would be the U.S. And this is what's something key to understand here about how Iran is waging this war. The U.S. is hiding. I would use the term hiding, or it's sheltering its F-35s at the Nevatim Air Base and some other key aerial assets at Ben Gurion International Airport. Israel's air defenses are much more concentrated and therefore more effective than what we've seen in Saudi Arabia, where the U.S. has lost AWACS aerial radar systems on the ground. They've lost C-130 Hercules transport planes on the ground. They've lost billion-dollar radar systems that are their eyes and ears at Al Udeid Air Base. And you'll see like these bases will be hit and THAAD systems aren't even going off. Patriot missiles aren't even in the air. Nevatim Air Base remains a mystery to us, though, where the F-35s are being housed. And when you see it come under attack, it's often from a Khorramshahr missile with cluster warheads. So maybe the propellant system of the missile will get intercepted, but the cluster warheads come down on Nevatim Air Base and they hit something there, but we don't know what it is. The censorship is so extreme. And you remember, Judge, you interviewed Jeremy Lofredo, who was reporting for the Gray Zone when he was arrested inside Israel and initially put on trial for spying. Fortunately, he was able to get out. These charges were completely bogus. And what had he done? One of the only things he did was he went outside Nevatim Air Base, well outside. He never tried to get in and took a picture of a ballistic missile that had landed nearby during, I think it was Operation True Promise 2 that Iran waged in retaliation for Israeli attacks. So that tells you how strict the censorship is, that if anyone even attempts to take pictures of the attacks on Nevatim, they face spying charges, treason, and could go to jail for life. So we don't know if the F-35s have been hit, but then we have to ask the question, why did an F-15E go down in Iran if the F-35 is supposed to be sort of the undefeatable stealth aircraft? Could it be because they've lost several of them on the ground? Again, we don't know. This is up to OSINT, open source sleuths, other reporters. But another question, why is Planet Labs, Planet, the major satellite imaging company that contracts with the Pentagon, refusing to release images of the region? It's because they're hiding losses on the ground. And Iran's attacks on these airfields, striking U.S. aerial assets before they're even in the air, have been very effective, and the cover-up is underway.
The New York Times yesterday had a lengthy, what it called, investigative piece purporting to recount the backstory on Trump's decision to attack Iran. What is your understanding of what the backstory is?
Well, this was published by two kind of Beltway Access reporters who were publishing a book, I think, called Regime Change. It's sort of an excerpt from their book. It's kind of impressive how they got it out so quickly. I guess neither of them have kids. I don't know how they do this, but it tells the same story that we told at the Gray Zone last year. So it really rings true for me. Last year, Anya Parampil and I reported, based on sourcing inside the White House, that Trump was being briefed with these, specifically by the Mossad director, David Barnea, and the Israeli Army chief of staff. And they were briefing the head of CENTCOM and CIA director, John Ratcliffe, and telling them that Iran was a week away from getting a nuclear weapon and that they needed the latitude to go in and kill Iran's then leader, Ali Khamenei, who was killed on the first day of this assault, Operation Epstein Fury, on Iran on February 28th. And that John Ratcliffe was basically serving as the Mossad stenographer, and that Trump was not really pushing back on any of the disinformation being fed to him. This is what we were told through the New York Times took place on February 11th when Netanyahu was in town here in Washington. He was being treated like the president, had massive Secret Service escorts. They were shutting down highways around D.C. You could see helicopters in the air. We all knew why he was here. I knew a war was on the horizon when he was here. And we subsequently learned from this report that Netanyahu actually went into a Situation Room briefing with the head of the Mossad behind him on sort of like a live stream. And he sat at the head of the table and Trump sat to the side, which is very unusual. And Netanyahu told Trump, Iran is a week away from a nuclear weapon. You must let us go in. Iran will start attacking the United States soon, and we need to kill Iran's leader. And once we decapitate its leadership, then the Iranians will rise up in the streets, and it will be a quick lightning blitzkrieg. Regime change will take place overnight. Trump nodded his head, and quietly, Marco Rubio, CENTCOM Chief Dan Kane, J.D. Vance, all the others who were privy to this meeting, even Susie Wiles, who had worked on Benjamin Netanyahu's 2020 campaign, they said this is absolute bullshit. They all said that, and none of them stood up to Trump because they're all yes men and women. Everyone's afraid of Trump, and so Trump authorized the war. And here we are, well over a month later, and the United States has lost the war. The U.S. has lost the war within the first week.
What does Trump have to show for the 6 weeks of killing and destruction? No regime change, no destruction or removal of enriched uranium, no neutering of ballistic missiles, and the Strait of Hormuz totally under the control of the Iranians. Open when they want it, close when they want it, charge a toll when they want it.
Exactly. Iran is stronger than before. Now, Iran has suffered heavy destruction to its infrastructure through terrorist attacks carried out by the U.S.-Israeli coalition. Three major steel plants attacked, petrochemical plants attacked, bridges and so forth. But this hasn't weakened Iran as a sovereign power. Iran is stronger because of its assertion of control over the Strait of Hormuz, where 20% of commerce passes through. And now they're implementing a toll system. As the Financial Times just reported, the tolls are being paid through cryptocurrency. And I know Trump is trying to get in on the action because all he cares about is enriching himself. So he would want for World Liberty Financial to be one of the crypto conduits for crypto. This is the one of the corruption channels that's presided over by Trump's sons and the Witkoff sons, as well as Tether, in which Trump's commerce secretary, Howard Lutnick, owns a, I think, 5% stake. And his son essentially oversees all the business dealings of Tether in El Salvador. Tether is the main stablecoin. So Trump's actually trying to just get in on this toll system rather than, which would consolidate Iran's strength and recognize Iran as a legitimate, powerful country among the community of nations. And when I say Iran, I also mean the Islamic Republic, which means that Iran has achieved sanctions relief. And it didn't achieve sanctions relief under the Democrats, who sought to use the JCPOA through the reformist leadership of Hassan Rouhani and Javad Zarif as a means of containing Iran and actually weakening Iran as a regional, if not world, power. They received sanctions relief through the assertion of the IRGC and the military power and prowess of Iran and the strength of the mobilization of the Iranian public in support of this war. They achieved sanctions relief under Trump, a Republican president who is essentially controlled by Israel. And if that dynamic holds, then this will strengthen the Islamic Republic and the revolutionary class of Iran against those who have sought, negotiating with the West as a way out. And it will fully discredit. I think it fully discredits the West and particularly the U.S. as a negotiating partner, just as this ceasefire discredits it, just as Donald Trump's satanic yet idle, so far idle threats to destroy an entire civilization discredits it.
Where are the American Zionists on this? Where's your friend Congressman Randy Fine on this? They can't be very happy.
I mean, Mark Levin is one of the more influential figures here. This someone as talentless as the carnival barker, Mark Levin, has emerged as a really influential figure because he's speaking on behalf of Netanyahu. And obviously, they were furious about the ceasefire, and so they got the Lebanon massacre. And I think they have successfully blown up the ceasefire. However, we have to pay attention to the dynamics inside Iran, where there are signs going up inside metro stations in Tehran declaring that we will not abandon Lebanon. At rallies, calls for retaliation against Israel for what they've done in Lebanon. But Iran has already retaliated with something more powerful, which is to ensure the continued closure of the Strait of Hormuz, which Donald Trump can do nothing about. And they still have the Bab el-Mandeb card to lay on the table, which would further harm the global economy. The price of crude has just gone up and Donald Trump's approval has just gone down once again. So Iran may not even have to retaliate against Israel to do damage. Spain is opening up an embassy in Tehran. Iran is moving out of the diplomatic isolation that's been imposed on it for 47 years. They have a key channel to Pakistan. They're opening up diplomatic channels all around the world because everyone has to deal with them in order to have an economy. And France is moving to open up a diplomatic channel to Lebanon to include it as part of any ceasefire deal. So, and of course, and you've talked about this with your other guests in more detail, Trump has fully destroyed NATO. NATO can never come back from this. And Mark Rutte looks like the biggest clown. He's discredited himself in front of the American public as he's here in Washington for the semi-secret Bilderberg meeting over at the Salamander Hotel. Perfect name for a gathering of reptilian shapeshifters.
Where are the Democrats on this? And what is there of an anti-war movement in the United States?
Great question. I mean, there is an anti-war movement that's out in the streets today. They've been in front of the White House, and the Democrats have done everything they can to distance themselves from it. Chuck Schumer, I bet in his heart of hearts, supported this war when it started. And now that it's going poorly, he's attacking Trump from the neocon right for not doing enough damage to Iran and not doing enough harm to Iran's sovereignty, and basically saying it's a stupid war simply because Iran is winning, not because it's slaughtering people inside Iran, destroying their infrastructure. We've almost heard nothing from them. There's been so little action on a war powers resolution. There's been so little that I start to question if the Democrats actually wanted to goad Trump into this war because they thought it would harm him, and that they want the war to continue because it will weaken Trump, which shows how unprincipled they are. You can also look at someone else who's been one of the more outspoken Democrats in the Senate, Chris Murphy, on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, who it seemed like he was against it. Then as soon as Trump moved towards a ceasefire, Chris Murphy's on the, all over the networks attacking Trump and saying that he's weak and that he has surrendered to Iran. So the Democrats represent nothing but partisanship here, and they're not doing what they did during the Iraq War, which is to send their own constituents, the union members, the MoveOn.org push organizations, out into the streets to supplement the anti-war movement, because I think they might actually want this war to continue. So this has been discrediting to the Democrats. People are looking for leadership. The Democratic Party base is not only against this war, but solidly against Israel. Against Israel. A new Pew poll shows a majority of Americans have a negative view of Israel. The support for Israel within the Democratic Party is like in the single digits. But which candidate will rise from the pack to actually give voice to this consensus among the Democratic base? So far, maybe Ro Khanna, but the rest are on the side of the donor class that represents the Zionist 1%. And this means that a major civil war is brewing for the DNC, and this will be a key issue. Let's consider how Netanyahu is destroying Trump's presidency. Israel's destroying Trump's presidency. He got way too close to this frenemy. I wonder if that golden pager that Netanyahu gave him will explode if Donald Trump moves too far away. And he remember that Netanyahu destroyed Joe Biden, and Netanyahu destroyed Kamala Harris, because neither of them could withdraw themselves from this predatory relationship with Israel.
Well, as we came on air, Melania Trump issued a statement saying she did not have a relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. But she also said that every woman who was abused by Epstein or his friends should testify publicly. I guess that also means the woman who accused her husband of abusing her when she was 9 years old. But when she was asked her opinion about the war, she said, it's all about the children. Chris, cut number 9.
Madam First Lady, can you tell us your message to children who find themselves in war zone during this Holy Week?
Well, all of this is happening for their future, so they will be safe in years to come.
My husband is trying to kill Iranians to save their children. Did you know about the 175 girls that were incinerated in their school?
Yeah, and I love the lounge music in the background as the camera pans back to the former game show host who's president. It's like, he's just going to be like, hotcha.
Right.
He wearing a leisure suit there and smoking like a bubble pipe with surrounded by Playboy bunnies. I mean, that's his world. So Melania Trump was asked, do you have a relationship with Jeffrey Epstein? She should be asked if she has a relationship with Donald Trump, because it's my understanding that they haven't lived together for some time, for years. And this is all for show. He seems to get more private time with Laura Loomer than his own wife,
wow,
who is now become a real perfect visualization of the decline and collapse of the R2P doctrine. You remember that? The responsibility to protect doctrine, in which the United States has to use its vast air power in order to stop the next Holocaust and save the children of the ethnic Albanians or the Bosnians, or to save the children of Syria by bombing the evil dictator back to the Stone Age. That was initially marketed by a New Yorker correspondent in Yugoslavia named Samantha Power, who then became sort of a fixture at Harvard University's Kennedy School and then in the Obama administration. And now it's being articulated by a former catalog bride named Melania Trump. So it really shows how Donald Trump is not expressing some new war criminal rhetoric or presenting a new doctrine of U.S. imperial power. He's simply lifting the mask on what has always been a criminal empire and exposing the false justifications of spreading freedom and democracy as a gigantic hoax. And there's simply nothing left there except raw power, raw force, and threats to wipe out civilizations, which are even alienating his own base, as well as one of the only constituencies in this country that was willing to get out in the streets and cheer for this war. I'm talking about Persian expats from Westwood, LA and suburban Washington, DC. They now see that Trump wants to destroy all of Iran. Reza Pahlavi, their leader, the clown prince based in Potomac, Maryland, who has not been to Iran since he was a small boy, just unfollowed Donald Trump on Twitter X. And that should tell you something.
Wow. Max, you're such a wealth of information and analysis and personal courage. Thank you, my dear friend. If anybody wants to know why I called you the golden boy, all they have to do is listen to you. Thank you. My best to Anya and to your children. I won't tell her about that crack you made about these people can only write a book if they don't have kids, but it's probably true. All the best to you, my friend. Thank you so much.
Great seeing you, Judge. Thanks a lot.